I know a lot of my regular subscribers to the tape cassettes would like comments about Ronald Reagan and his running mate, George Bush. But I'm going back, as I say, on KLRB next week. And I think I'll just reserve my opinions of the ticket. Those of you who are familiar with my research know pretty well what I think about that ticket. And for the others, I think I'll just reserve my comments and calm down a little. Right now, I just feel like puking. The one encouraging thing about their candidacy is that I was listening to the news yesterday, and they were describing the television reporting during the Republican convention. And I think overall, the network coverage, only 27% of the listening public listened to the Republican convention. And when Ronald Reagan arrived in Detroit, according to the news service, there were some soap operas on, such as Hospital and other shows out here on the West Coast at that particular time. And people called in and they were furious and angry that they interrupted the soap opera with Ronald Reagan's arrival in Detroit. So if that gives you any inkling, I hope that just those 27% are the only ones that go to the polls. And I hope you don't get divided between an Anderson or a Carter, or turn against Carter the way the media is turning you. God knows he's horrible. And he has Brzezinski breathing down his neck like a dragon. But there's a Congress that's balancing out or cooling off Brzezinski after that ridiculous failure trying to get the hostages. But I'll have a lot to say about Ronald Reagan for weeks and weeks to come. I've talked a lot about Jimmy Carter and the narcotic connections, but I think I'll wait to talk about the Republican conventions and more on Ronald Reagan next week, where we can share again with the audience here on the West Coast, because it will be important to get as much out as we can about this beast up till the point of the elections. Not that what May Brussels says is going to affect the elections in any way, and I have no illusions about that, but yet information does have a way of seeping around to people who might otherwise vote differently, and hopefully influence more of you who are not registered to get out there and vote. And don't be so cool and think that a non-vote is a protest. A non-vote is begging the next four justices on the Supreme Court to be appointed by Ronald Reagan. There's a new book out, interesting book. I don't have it. Sometimes I give you information about books that are out and you get them before me or at the same time that I do, but I want to alert you to them because sometimes they're off the stand before they ever get known. They get out and somebody sweeps them all up. So before I even get to them, I have to alert you at times. This book that I'm reading about now in the newspapers is called Jack, The Struggles of John F. Kennedy, an author by the name of Herbert S. Parmet. And it's a new book that claims that John Kennedy was living with a suspected Nazi spy. He was working in the Office of Navy Intelligence during World War II. That was a time period where his father was hoping that Joe Kennedy, the older brother, would become president of the United States, and there's a book out on the possible murder, the sabotage of the airplane that he was killed in. And there was a lot of concern. John Kennedy's father was ambassador to the court in Great Britain and brought home because he was so pro-Nazi. J. Edgar Hoover thought he was an embarrassment. Even the director of the FBI and vice president of Interpol didn't want Americans so overtly Nazi. It was supposed to be under the tables. And Joe Kennedy was brought home. And John Kennedy was with a woman. I've heard these stories before, Inga Arvid, a Nazi. And the excuse for bugging John Kennedy when he was in the Office of Navy Intelligence was that he was with this woman who possibly was a Nazi agent. The book describes that she was 4 years older than him. He was 24 at the time. He was single. And the FBI had suspicions about her. She attended the 1936 Berlin Olympics with Adolf Hitler. And Franklin Roosevelt had ordered the agencies to bug Kennedy, John Kennedy, because he was going with this woman who was known to be a Nazi. And according to stories that I've heard before, Joe Kennedy had his son switched to the South in the Pacific in the battlefield to get away from this particular woman, maybe because of her links to Adolf Hitler. But he was sent out where he was almost killed on that boat, wrote a book about it. His life was almost ended over in the Pacific. But The book brings up the subject that J. Edgar Hoover had a chance to blackmail John Kennedy from 1942 until the time of his assassination in Dallas, that he had tape recordings of him evidently making love with this particular woman, and while he became a hero on the PT-109, his romance with a known Nazi was in the hands of J. Edgar Hoover from 1942 until 1936. Now, that is something that the blackmail and setting various people up, young people, with women, Nazis, narcotics, or whatever, is common to the FBI. It was common to Adolf Hitler. It was common to the politicians in the United States, in Las Vegas, New York, Miami. It came out at the time of Watergate, the intent of John Mitchell, the Attorney General of the United States, to fix various members of the Congress up on boats and at the convention. Democratic convention, and what they would do, take young people, young aspiring congressmen, and photograph them and bug them making love and with various women, and then later when they run for office they can pull them out 10, 15, 20 years later and blackmail them and switch their votes and get them to vote the way they want and control them because of their expertise in bed or whether they're disloyal to their wives. In this case, John Kennedy wasn't married, but he was with a known Nazi. There's an interesting telephone suicide pact discussed in the newspapers that I thought we should call attention to. Sometimes we talk about strange deaths that don't get too much attention. This was June 14, 1980, just a month ago, from Switzerland. A Swiss industrialist and his divorced wife died in a suicide pact made by telephone minutes before he was to be arrested and a suspect of a $62 million fraud case. Officers arrived at the luxury home of Bulgarian-born A. Pinkas, P-I-N-K-A-S, shortly after he killed himself. Probably he took cyanide. There's a disease called, I mentioned many times, apparent heart attacks. This is probably cyanide. His former wife, Florence Molaz, killed herself, probably, at the same time in Cannes, France. Police confiscated documents at the Pincus home. He claimed he caused damage to more than 10 Swiss and foreign banks, as well as private persons, and obtained $62 million in credit through falsified banking sheets. Pincus came to Switzerland as a chemistry student in 1941. Before the end of World War II, he discovered a revolutionary method to industrialize production of nitrous oxide or laughing gas. Pincus had chemical plants throughout Europe and Latin America in the 1960s. He was on the board of directors of seven companies, including a local bank. He and his wife were divorced for tax reasons, but maintained close relationships. I think it's interesting that he supposedly swallowed this poison in Switzerland. His wife took the same kind of poison in Cannes, France. Nothing conclusive about their deaths. They worked for a chemical company. But the important point, I think, is where did the $62 million go? Lately, if you've been reading the newspapers, you see $2 million, $4 million, $10 million, $14 million, $20 million swindles, such as the Michael Sindona case with the $45 million swindle at the Franklin National Bank in New York. But where is the money going? Is it going to the rightist military forces controlling this fascist organization around the world? There's unlimited millions and millions of dollars going around, and people like this, when they're about to be arrested or indicted, are found dead from apparent cyanide poisoning, but absolutely no proof that they weren't murdered. There was an article in the the Washington Post this last April that I haven't been able to get around to you. I have so much information and files I want to share. But this has to do with the death of John Paisley, and those of you that study the John Kennedy assassination and keep up on that may not have been aware that there was an intelligence report. The Senate Intelligence Committee came out with a report this April investigating CIA official John Paisley. He died in September of 1978. And the latest report of the Senate Intelligence Committee claims that the critical question of whether John Paisley was murdered or commit suicide will remain a secret. The committee chairman, Birch Bayh from Indiana, and vice chairman, Barry Goldwater from Arizona were part of this committee. Keep in mind that Arizona is the state where Joseph Mengele's presided under the nose of Barry Goldwater in Arizona. Now, John Paisley, I did an article for Penn Jones on John Paisley's death at the time the House Select Committee on Assassinations was doing their work, and I have several tapes on that going back to 1979, tape number 372 and 373. The House Select Committee on Assassinations was hearing the story of Yuri Nosenko, and a Mr. Hart from the Central Intelligence Agency was allowed to testify before the committee on the conditions that he didn't talk about Lee Harvey Oswald, but he was talking about Nosenko, this Russian defector who I claimed worked with Lee and Marina Oswald in the Soviet Union. And the very week that this testimony was going on, September the 15th, 1978, was at the time of the testimony of John Hart from the CIA before the House Select Committee on Assassinations. And a week later, John Paisley, a man who worked with Lee Harvey Oswald and had to have access to his information in the Soviet Union, was found dead. September 23rd, 1978, Paisley was dead, and John Hart was just testifying on September the 15th. Now, that House Intelligence, the Senate Intelligence Committee, is telling us in 1980 that they will not reveal whether he was murdered or commit suicide. And yet we know that John Roselli had testified before Senator Church's committee and was murdered right afterwards, and Sam Giancana, who was to testify before the Senate about the assassinations in the United States, and the CIA, was murdered a week before he was to testify. And Sheffield Edwards had testified, and William Harvey had been murdered. The fact that witnesses before the Senate Intelligence Committee are murdered just prior or after their testimony is important. All you have to do is add up the amount of deaths of people testifying, and they can't pass off. They do pass off, but they shouldn't be able to pass off a statement that whether he was murdered or commit suicide will remain secret. The point I'm trying to make is that the assassination teams that made it possible for Adolf Hitler to get into power in 1933 are nothing compared to what's going on right now in the House of Representatives and the Senate of the United States in 1980. And yet we're literally unable to extricate ourselves from the reality of the everyday world to that kind of thing that's going on in Washington. If you want to understand how Hitler came to power, just look at your own hopelessness or helplessness right now. There's nothing we can do. They sent a report. There's no credible evidence other than a suicide, and yet I have documents that they should word statements, there's no credible evidence, into the investigation, for example, of a conspiracy with Jack Ruby, because we did not look into it. Therefore, we can say there's no credible evidence. They admitted they delayed in fingerprinting the body. They cremated it without his widow seeing it. They covered up the importance of Mr. Paisley with the Central Intelligence Agency. They covered up his relationship to Lee Harvey Oswald in the Soviet Union. The body was weighted down with 38 pounds of weight, shot in the head, thrown out in the river 1 week after the testimony of not only John Hart of the CIA, but Hart was close to Paisley. John Paisley and his wife, both Marianne Paisley, worked for the CIA. The immediate superior in the CIA to Marianne Paisley was Catherine Hart, the woman whose husband was testifying before the House Select Committee on Assassinations. Catherine Hart and John Lyman Hart, Marianne Paisley and John Paisley were all very close, as was Yuri Nosenko, the KGB agent who actually worked for the Galen operation and for the Central Intelligence Agency. So you have John Hart talking about Yuri Nosenko, and the man who really would know the connections was John Paisley. A week after Hart testified, it was never cross-examined, of course, Paisley was found dead. All of that happened in 1978, but in 1980, the Washington Post reports that the Senate Intelligence Committee has informed the widow of John Paisley that they will not disclose, it will remain secret, whether he was murdered or commit suicide. The top article in the Washington Post says, "Full report on Paisley's death is to stay secret. The Senate closes the probe on the ex-CIA agent and keeps it a secret." The same Intelligence Committee keeps it a secret on Leo Ryan's death in Jonestown. A member of the House of Representatives, the man who formed the Watchdog Committee on the CIA that used Ryan Bill to stop counterintelligence, is murdered down in Guyana, and the Senate, again, and the Intelligence Committee covers up that murder. So the John Paisley story is not over. It's not closed for you assassination buffs, in case you didn't know it. The full report is to remain secret, which is tantamount to saying the man was murdered. But the committee back there, of course, would refuse to make the connections between the Hart testimony, the role of Hart to Paisley, Nosenko, and Lee Harvey Oswald. And the reason it's closed is, again, it would go back to the murder of the President of the United States. And that is something that cannot be opened up until most of the main people involved are dead. That includes people like Robert Mayhew, Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, John Cooper, the remaining members of the Warren Commission. It will take another 10 or 15 years until they're dead for the truth to really come out. I mentioned a few weeks ago that the head of the Los Angeles Police Commission, President Stephen Reinhart, was considered for a judgeship, and the Senate Judiciary was supposed to pass upon his qualifications. The Los Angeles Police Department has been described as one of the most homicidal in the United States. There's reports out on the police department in Los Angeles and their shooting of blacks and minorities, that they not only shoot, but they shoot to kill, that they aim and get and kill almost more than any other police department in the United States. There have been investigations in Washington, D.C., of various police departments. As I've mentioned before, these aren't local, city, or state problems. This is a national problem. And this particular judge was cleared by the Justice Department. The gentleman testifying against him, one of the main witnesses in the Abscam investigation, the informant Joseph Hauser, has been ruled aside, and Reinhart was cleared by the Justice Department. An article in the Los Angeles Times that followed said, "The United States refutes its own informant and backs the nomination of Mr. Reinhart." I can't believe it, but I guess, again, I can, that here's a man who's been named by a top informant working with Carlos Marcello, the assassination teams, organized crime, and the mobsters, and links a president of the Los Angeles Police Commission to that gang, and the judiciary, again, says he's qualified to be a judge in Los Angeles. There's another article interesting. This Maxine Cheshire has some wonderful pieces of news in her column. It comes out every week in the Washington Post. She's been writing the society section for the Washington Post for a long time. And she had an article on one of Jackie Onassis's new boyfriends, Maurice Templesman. I don't know if you saw that article or not, but this article says that if she hitched up with this man, he's richer than Aristotle Onassis. He's politically powerful. He's secretive. He's head of one of the world's largest mineral consortiums in the United States, France, South Africa, and Japan. And he's a close friend and business associate of Mobutu and Zaire, where the Germans have built many rocket systems that would cover or control all of Africa. When Germany wasn't allowed to build these rockets, they were allowed to build them in South Africa. Jackie's new boyfriend, according to the story, owns 80% of the world's richest copper and cobalt mines in Zaire. He has minerals, United States, France, South Africa, and Japan. He is heavy into diamond mines, Sierra Leone, and so forth, oil rigs in Texas. He owns an oil company in Dallas, Texas. But the important thing is not only his extreme wealth and his mobility and his secretiveness, but Jackie Onassis is going with a person who is very close personally and funded Richard Nixon's campaign. That fits very much into the Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy story, the saga that I've put together through the years of the role of the Bouviers in betraying France, in espionage, their links to Napoleon, to the rebuilding and resurgence of the armies that would fight the Soviet Union someday. Somehow Jacqueline attaches herself to some very important people that were involved in assassinations and assassination teams. If John Kennedy was under surveillance by the Federal Bureau of Investigations from 1942 on and was in the Senate, moving his way up politically, and Jacqueline Bouvier is a photographer who comes to him and marries him, Their marital relationship was always cold. He always had other women to play around with. She apparently couldn't care less, which isn't true. Most women don't react that way. She was with Aristotle Onassis just before John Kennedy was murdered. She was over in Greece. Onassis was right back with her. As soon as the assassination took place, he was the first person in the White House, I understand, with Jacqueline Onassis. Another link of Onassis, there's many links of him to the assassination teams and the murder of John Kennedy and the people around John Kennedy and the Nazi organizations. But Johnny Meyer, who was the press agent for Aristotle Onassis and Howard Hughes, worked for Howard Hughes and Aristotle Onassis also, was very, very close to Errol Flynn and the Gestapo. This whole can of worms of Nazis, assassins, and the death of political leaders, many of them, including John Kennedy, is a close, very close-knit clique. And in the middle of it always is Jacqueline Bouvier Onassis. Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy Onassis, I should say. As I say, Charles Hyman, in the book on Errol Flynn, The Untold Story About His Nazi Connections, refers to Errol's pimp and henchman, Johnny Meyer. That's the man that worked for Onassis and for Howard Hughes and worked with Errol Flynn. And he tells how Johnny Meyer met his death in 1978, I believe it was. It's in the book, how he was repairing a car and the car went backwards and crushed a Meyer. That was in Florida. Just, while Watergate was unfolding and a lot of scandals were coming out and exposés of Howard Hughes and so forth, a very important connecting link to all of these stories was run over by his own automobile that crushed him, came rolling down on top of him and crushed Johnny Myers after this infamous and scandalous career with all the biggies. Speaking of current deaths, I don't know if you noticed in the newspapers, there was a Reuters story, not in the American newspapers, Cardinal Pinadoli, official at the Vatican, died. According to Reuters, the cardinal was one of the main Italian favorites, a candidate to become the pope, after the death in 1978 of John Paul I, and then John Paul II, after 34 days, took over. Remember the cartoons about the poisoning and the killing of John Paul I, and then the Polish pope, handpicked by Brzezinski, became the head of the Vatican. This man was the Vatican ambassador to Bolivia and Venezuela. He's been a cardinal since 1973, but was suggested as one of the main favorites of the Italians. He quietly died, the cardinal, just several weeks ago. There also has been a follow-up about the attempted murder in Fort Wayne, Indiana, of Vernon Jordan of the National Urban League. Indiana is the home of the Tom Charles Houston plan, the combined military intelligence CIA Defense Department plans for wiretapping, bugging, counterintelligence, and terrorism. Indiana is the home state of Senator Lugar, suggested as a possible vice president to Ronald Reagan. Luckily, he wasn't put in. There's a foundation in Indiana, Bloomington, Indiana, that Spiro Agnew is the head of, a neo-fascist organization in the home state of Jim Jones, with a nucleus not only of where the SLA was formed, but the mind control program that was to be instigated in Guyana with various American citizens that would be shipped down there for experimentation. So it's no wonder that Mr. Jordan was shot at Fort Wayne, Indiana. Now, there's an article just 2 weeks ago in the newspaper, three men in a car were following Jordan, and the FBI said they could have shot him, returning to an early theory that a carload of men who were shouting at Mr. Jordan and Martha Coleman could have shot him is now coming out again by the FBI. He was with a white woman who works for International Harvesters. She took him to the home for a few minutes, but this could create the motive. A white woman taking him to the Marriott Hotel, they were yelling at him, and then they shot at him. If it wasn't a well-coordinated conspiracy concealed by the FBI as the FBI hid the John Kennedy assassination at Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King, they could have found those cars with those people. There were three white men who allegedly were angry at seeing Mrs. Coleman, a white volunteer with the local Urban League, in the company of a black man. That would take it away from a national and international conspiracy into three men that just didn't like to see white women with black men. It doesn't explain how they escape the police network. It was similar to the shooting of Dr. Marcus Foster in Oakland at the time he was shot. When the SLA shot him, he was with a white man. The black man got cyanide bullets. The white man survived and was not killed. And weeks before, the Klan and the Nazi Party had handed out brochures about this combination working together. So the intent was that the fatal bullets hit the black man. So in this case, the woman wasn't shot. It was similar to the SLA shooting or the Dr. Marcus Foster shooting out here in Oakland. The FBI knew about these people. They knew about the car. They knew that they had yelled at them. And when they went to the Marriott Hotel and they got out of the parking lot, Vernon Jordan was shot. And now, weeks later, even though the shooting was May 29th, they're admitting, yes, that car could have been the one with the assassins in it. You know, these assassinations and wiping out of witnesses and constant killing of important American citizens goes a long way back. It didn't just begin yesterday, and it's not going to end tomorrow. But it's something that we have to be made aware of how often it's happened, and begin to add up the statistics, not individual biographies or obituaries of people, but a continuous series of how many political scientists, how many civil rights leaders, how many black students, how many rock musicians, and so forth. There was an obituary of a man named Paul Hall. He was president of the Seafarers Union. The Washington Post described him in this way: in the late 1940s and early 50s, a major problem on the waterfront was racketeering. This was during World War II and right after World War II. Mr. Hall and his union cooperated with the New York State Crime Commission and set up penalties, including dismissal of peoples that were involved in narcotic smuggling. In 1949, an effort was made to frame Mr. Hall by planting a quantity of narcotics in his automobile. In 1954, there was an attempt to assassinate him. What Mr. Hall wasn't aware of, or probably caught on very quickly to, was the fact that organized crime was working with the OSS, the CIA, that the violently anti-communist Sicilian mafia and the syndicate have always worked with the defense, the police, against labor, against civil rights movements, and so forth, and can be used as assassination teams hand in hand. So when a man begins to break up racketeering or smuggling in New York City or wherever it is, then they planted narcotics on him and tried to murder him. The murder attempt was foiled, luckily, but the point is this goes back to the 40s and 50s and those same methods of getting rid of people who catch on to these various conspiracies has been continuous. It's been going on for a long, long time. There was a murder in Texas, and the covering of a material and forging information and framing a young woman that is important, I thought I better bring up on these tapes because it may later turn out to have something to do with the John Kennedy assassination. A woman named Phyllis Pearl Tucker, 52-year-old woman, manager of a Dobbs House restaurant in Dallas, Texas, at the airport, was found murdered, and the police and the law enforcement tried to blame her daughter. She has a daughter, Tammy Lynn Harrison, 17-year-old girl, and they forced a confession from her about her mother's murder. And as the story became more open and in the news, they discovered that the testimony against her had been forced to confess, that she was threatened, and that the crime had been forged by the Dallas Police Department, and that according to the latest reports, there were three other people with motives to kill Tammy's mother, but the motives have not yet been disclosed, and they may never well be unless we get into them and discuss them on the air and throw this around. According to a large article in the Los Angeles Times, the whole investigation was messed up by police officers. Prosecutor Henry Wade, who prosecuted the case, who tried Lee Harvey Oswald in about 4 hours and found him guilty of the murder of John Kennedy, was one of the people who prosecuted this and said that she was the one who did the murder. The young daughter asked for a lie detector test. They had refused to give it to her. She said she didn't murder her mother. And the attorney representing her is Bob Hinton. Hinton is the law partner of Phil Burleson, and Burleson was the co-counsel with Melvin Belli for Jack Ruby in the Lee Harvey Oswald case when Jack Ruby was prosecuted for killing Lee Harvey Oswald. The woman who was murdered, the mother of the young girl, was married to a Dallas police officer, Donald Tucker, and Jack Ruby was very close to members of the police department. And I think it's interesting that they tried to cover up by forging papers, forcing a confession. The Dallas police officers tried to cover up the murder of a woman who was married to a police officer who was also murdered and blame it on her daughter. An interested lawyer took the case and has cleared her. But the important thing, again, is that the law enforcement were actually involved in forcing confessions, forging papers, blaming a 17-year-old girl for murdering her mother. And all the while, these people could have played a part in covering up the Kennedy assassination, and they selected the daughter as the patsy. Our time is up again. This tape runs around too fast. I'll be back with you next week, and as I said before, we will be on the air. You'll get the tape a few days later. Take care, and we'll go more into the Republican convention next week. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California, and have a good week.